Politics, as we all know, is a very serious business, and regular listeners of this show know that we are nothing less than humorless, which is why we have temporarily muzzled our host. The Batsegundo Show momentarily abdicates its literary coverage for a talk with Carl Sheeler, a politician from Rhode Island and a man determined to become senator. That is, if he can win the September 12th primary. You be the judge. It's your call. It's your voice. It's your country. So I am here with Carl Sheeler, who is the Democratic primary candidate for the Senate in Rhode Island. Carl, how are you doing?
I am doing very well. Thank you for asking, Ed.
Oh, well, that's what we try to do around here. Well, this is actually interesting because your campaign actually approached me, and I'm just some California literary podcaster asking me to interview you. Are you trying to run an unorthodox campaign here? It struck me as a very sort of, you know, idiosyncratic, kind of quirky way to sort of, we'll get into what you stand for later, but I'm just curious about this. Maybe you could explain, were you taking a page from the Howard Dean playbook, or?
I think maybe personality types. Howard Dean and I are very, very similar. I think our backgrounds are very, very different. Howard Dean comes from a four-generation investment banking family. I come from a moderate, modest background where my grandparents were through Ellis Island. I would say if it makes it quirky, it's because I think I speak the way a Democrat used to speak in the 1960s and 70s. If the president has violated the Constitution in multiple areas, if it's been found by a senior congressman with 30 years experience and the minority leader in the House Judicial Committee that he's violated 26 laws, I have to ask the question, what is it that the president has to do before the Democrats are going to find him accountable to the constitutional laws that we're all to adhere to and his oath that he's to adhere to? If I'm the only Democrat that's currently running for office that back in July of last year provided a timeline and an exit strategy for withdrawal from Iraq so that in case that there was a civil war, which there was a provision in the Iraqi constitution that would allow the individual republics to divide, so that we don't currently have a recall, which is basically a backdoor draft, so that we're not throwing more military there as opposed to withdrawing, which is making it look more and more like Vietnam. If that's quirky, then call me quirky.
Well, it's more quirky in terms of the campaign, but well, let's talk about like this basically what separates you from Sheldon Whitehouse, who is the other major Democratic candidate in Rhode Island. I was looking at the party platform for both you, the platform for both you and Whitehouse, and I actually saw that, you know, both of you actually support an exit strategy. You favor an immediate pullout, whereas he favors more of a sort of, I guess, timetable by the end of the year. You both
That's changed.
Oh, it has.
His position, he's had three positions. His original position when he first announced was to stay the course. It wasn't until December of last year when it was very clear that the political winds were blowing that he changed his position to rapid and responsible, which in his belief meant that they would begin withdrawing by the end of the year. But since now the military is saying that we're in a civil war, he has changed his position again, saying that he thinks that about 4 to 8 months we should begin a withdrawal. What does that mean? So no, we're not similar, I'm sorry to say.
Well, maybe we can go ahead and talk about this, because your campaign has kind of billed you as the next Ned Lamont, but I look to a guy like Whitehouse, and I don't see, you know, him as, you know, a Lieberman type of candidate. He doesn't have a sort of Judas Kiss photograph actually circulating around the internet. What makes you, what is the disparity between you and him? Maybe you can sort of clear.
Sure, I'd be happy to share that in a number of ways. And before you jump the gun. Actually, there is a website that's been floating around for a while by a disenchanted, we believe it's from a disenchanted attorney that actually worked with him when he was the attorney general. And it's called SheldonSucks.org. As far as I think the question you're asking is, what's the differentiation between Sheldon and I, or what's the similarities between Sheldon and Lieberman?
Well, I guess so, because, I mean, I just don't see as much of a disparity between, you know, you and White House as I do with Lieberman and Lamont. I mean, you both support universal health care.
Yeah.
You both support abortion and oppose a flag burning amendment.
Well, okay, careful there. Again,
Well, clarify it for me.
I spend a good deal of my time reviewing opposition research where Sheldon specifically stands as opposed to generally stands on a stump speech. An example is that he said that he would never change the federal constitution for gay marriage if he was a U.S. senator. But when pushed on the issue during an interview, he said that he believes that it should be left to the individual states to decide whether there should be marriage equality. If you can think that through, you'll see that there's a big difference between the two. What he's basically said, particularly here in Rhode Island, where although we are a blue state, the current 85% that hold seats in our General Assembly, 80% of them are against gay marriage. Mm-hmm. So he's pretty much put it on notice that at least the people that had been supporting him, using gay marriage as an example, he's leaving them to their own devices. I don't consider that similarity. I would say that the great majority of the issues, Sheldon and I, are very disparate. From the time frames that we first took these positions to the detail that we've provided on these positions, if you take a very close look at Sheldon's positions, he doesn't talk about how they're going to be funded. He doesn't talk about, for example, his energy policies. He didn't even have energy policies as his cornerstone for his platform until both Stephen Laffey and I published detailed positions as to why.
At this point, our young roving correspondent, who we must remind our listeners is a hopeless amateur, lost power on his portable phone. Mr. Sheeler was flexible to this misfortune. Why? We still don't know. In any event, we apologize for this unexpected development, and we will flog the appropriate parties at our earliest opportunity and at the cheapest expense.
We were talking about the differences between you and White House, and maybe the best way to sort of respond to this question is to sort of basically, if you maybe you would you like to state your particular platform, or instead of actually pointing the finger to White House, perhaps you might describe some of your positions, and we can kind of riff from there.
Oh, that would be fine. I'd say one of the most strenuous ones that I have that clearly distinguished myself from Sheldon is my belief that the 15-term congressional Democrat John Conyers, who sits on the House Judiciary Committee, issued a 300-page report where he has found that Bush has violated his constitutional oath of executive office on at least 26 counts. Mm-hmm. Now, in my sense of what a progressive Democrat ought to be doing, whether it's popular or not, is hold this administration accountable, which means that if he's violated his oath of office, he needs to be held for those crimes.
Would you support, then, like an impeachment against President Bush?
I was the first federal candidate to actually draft a resolution in the state of Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. That was presented to our General Assembly under H.R. 635, which provides that the General Assembly, without the governor's concurrence, could send an expedited resolution that goes directly to the House floor. more. And it would be expedited, which means it would be heard before any other pending legislation. They were not going to do that. We pursued that on three occasions. Since that time, it is now currently on the floors of the state of Illinois, California, and I believe three other states. It has, although having no legal status, there's been at least 10 states' Democratic committees that have found Bush has committed impeachable offenses. So I think really becomes a question of, do we have individuals that have resolved? What I think is kind of interesting, and not to belabor the point, is Sheldon, of course, was our state's attorney general, probably knows better about the law than even I. Mm-hmm. And he has made it clear that he would not pursue impeachment. He feels that it would be divisive, and I would argue that our laws have to prevail above our politics.
But on the flip side, then, what would you do to sort of, you know, you're going to have to, as a senator, if you were to win the Democratic primary, you're going to have to actually compromise with a lot of, you know, ugly or, you know, contrary people. Do you think that's possible? I mean, for example, you know, we were talking about universal health care, and the Clintons back in 93 and 94 in a Democratic Senate couldn't get a universal health care proposal passed. What makes you able to actually go ahead and get something along those lines passed? What would you do to, you know, in the case of universal health care, work with the Senate to actually, you know, get this actually on the books? I mean, is it really even really possible?
I believe that it is, and I believe that what's ironic is a lot of things have changed even since the time that Hillary Clinton, I would argue, dropped the ball, because the passage of the bill got watered down because of the influence of the drug lobbying. And why I say things have changed considerably since that time is that municipalities are underfunded because of retirements for many of their workers, which includes, in many cases, full health care. General Motors has shipped 60,000 jobs out of the country because of health care. We have, at this point, about 45 million Americans that are currently not covered by health care, but the reality is that they can still go to an emergency room and it's picked up by the taxpayers at a much higher cost. So what it really boils down to at this point is that will two industries, that being the insurance industry, which Sheldon has received a considerable amount of contributions from, or the health, rather the pharmaceutical industry, have enough clout to sway all of these other large corporations that, in order to remain competitive, will need to find a way to have that burden shifted from their shoulders to that of a national health care system. And I would argue, now is the time.
Well, I mean, you know, I hear what you're saying in terms of now being the time. The problem is that the mechanisms of the Senate, particularly when it's, you know, the Hillary Clinton and her health care proposal came before a Democratic Senate, and some have considered that to sort of, you know, to essentially have opened up the floodgate for the so-called Republican Revolution of 1994. That was a Democratic-led Senate, and now we have a situation where, really, even though the pendulum seems likely to be swinging back to the Democrats, you're still dealing with the potential of a Republican-led Senate. You're still dealing with senators who have their own sort of notion of what that universal health care situation should be. So how do you actually, you know, find a kind of compromise point that sort of placates everyone?
I believe I already answered the question. I mean, if we say GOP, we're basically saying big business. Mm-hmm. They're answerable to big business. Big business can't afford to continue to operate the way that they are. Big business funds their campaigns. The incentives that they perhaps enjoyed after Democrats, I would say, relinquished their control of Congress, I would argue that Republicans will probably more closely align to some of the nonpartisan issues so that they don't continue to see an erosion of the influence that they still have. I would say it would be political suicide for the Republicans to say, no, I'm going to continue to vote down bills being passed that would create furtherance of a national health care system.
It may be political suicide from an ideological standpoint, but the fact of the matter is that the Senate, you know, works very much with the notion of, you know, trade-offs, of compromises, of deals.
I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah.
You're taking the position, and I think almost argumentatively, that, well, it's not going to happen because the Republicans are in control. And what I'm saying is because of the fact that big business controls the Republican agenda, and big business is probably going to want to see some form of national health care so that their profit margins still remain high, that'll bring to the table. That's part of the compromise, because the paradigm that existed 10 years ago is not the same one that exists now. So I would say that it would be a very bright move on the part of the Democrats that actually put some teeth to the position that they're representing the middle class, those that are feeling the greatest pinch on the cost of health care, so that they are actually addressing this as a nonpartisan issue. I think what was originally stemming your question is that I take a position that certainly would cause the GOP to bristle. It would probably cause many Democrats to bristle. But does it make it wrong? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, when you look at it from the standpoint of Clinton being one vote shy of being impeached by the Senate because he lied to the Congress, and clearly his infractions were considerably lower than the current administration, I would still argue, and I will continue to argue, and particularly if I am elected as a U.S. Senator, if it ever comes to the point where the Senate has to decide as the jury whether the president has broken his oath of office, I just want Rhode Islanders to know I'm going to vote yes. I would argue that one of the reasons that you have seen a reduction in the level of support for establishment Democrats is because they've lost the teeth. They've lost the convictions that essentially it's a one-party system masquerading as a two-party system, and I think that's probably part of what has caused a decline in the amount of voter turnout. So, personal opinion is if it was the shoe was on the other foot, the GOP would be on this like white on rice. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party has consistently, since it lost its control, has always been in a defensive posture, and I would argue that GOP congressional candidates, given the low popularity of President Bush, and if the possibility existed that their leader, if you will, could be up for impeachment and the public examining many of those counts, I think the public generally recognizes, particularly here in Rhode Island, where he has the lowest approval rating of any state in the country, it's 22%. If there was the opportunity between C-SPAN and the public and an outlining of some of these offenses, I don't care what that spin machine is that Karl Rove would produce, those candidates would do whatever they could to make sure that they kept distance between themselves and the ship that was sinking. Yes, it would slow down passing measures on the floor, but the question becomes is what kind of measures are being passed on the floor right now?
Sure.
These measures that have anything, any reflection of what's in the best interest of the American public.
Well, going back to this issue of health care, where would the money for this come from? I mean, what do you propose to sort of, you know, a lot of people have suggested, oh, employers have to pay for health care, or, you know, not just big business, but small businesses. And for a lot of small businesses, this is economically prohibitive. Would this come completely from, you know, an already kind of cash-strapped federal government? Or
cash is already there. Okay, when we say already cash-strapped, why is it cash-strapped?
Well,
it's deficit spending. It's created tax cuts for millionaires. It's reduced tax levels for corporations at the lowest level in the last 35 years. It's financing its war with 25% debt being paid for through China. So I think the question becomes, from the American public standpoint, is national health care more important than doing something that has very little to do with pursuing terrorism? So back to the question, how do you pay for national health care? Well, let's examine who's already paying for national health care. If we take a look at Medicare, if you take a look at Medicaid, if you take a look at local, state, and federal employees, retirees, if you take a look at military, if you take a look at veterans, 50% of all expenditures made through our taxes, whether it be at the property tax, state, or federal income tax level, is already being absorbed. So the question becomes, do we first examine the expense? And I would argue yes, as a financial guy. Absolutely. So what do we examine? For example, there is no economies of scale. You have multiple insurers. You have multiple entities with administrative processes that are not standardized. In almost every other industry, you do have standardization. I mean, literally, there should be an insurance card that has a microchip in it, and if you bring it to a provider, no matter where, it should be able to call up all the information on that particular patient, downloadable instantaneously. It doesn't exist. There's no incentive to do so. The only incentive would be for is the taxpayers and the corporations that we already talked about. So how much does that cost? Based on the best estimates of the experts that have been examining this industry, they said that the administrative costs constitute 30% of overall medical coverage. That's a huge cost. The next item is the cost of drugs, and some would argue over-drugging patients. Mm-hmm. The margin, typical margin for a pharmaceutical industry company runs between 15 and 25%. They argue that they need that profit so that they can fund R&D, but a lot of times that R&D is partially funded by our federal government. The federal government has the ability to provide a fast tracking through FDA approval, provide universities through which there is a sharing of intellectual property as well as the creation of the final product. And if the federal government wants to be in the business of providing national health care, they can also be in the business to make sure that we're not getting gouged by the drug companies. So if you were to minimize the profits from the standpoint of having it on a competitive bid basis, if you were to minimize the profits by not extending the patents on proprietary drugs so that they can charge a higher cost, if you minimize the ability to bring in foreign drugs that have oftentimes been used for decades, but they pose a competitive threat to American drug companies, that's not in the best interest of the American population. If you take a look at those costs, you're already at the other 50%. Now, what would that mean? What that would mean is then you'd have a corporation, instead of a corporation picking up the medical expenses, the taxpayer who is already picking it up would be picking up a more efficient system. What does that mean? Corporations generate greater profits because they're not paying for the medical care. Those profits then would, of course, be taxed. That tax goes into the revenue base in the federal government, and that's a win-win across the board because what it does is small businesses then have a more level playing field competing against larger businesses where the majority of the population goes towards larger corporations because of their offering of health care.
But you only have a matter of years to go ahead and, you know, pursue the corporations and the companies that are actually putting out these drugs. I mean, for example, on the drug question, you also have the issue of generic drugs. Like, there's companies such as McKesson, who, that's their bread and butter. They make the money based off of, you know, actually going ahead and...
patents.
I'm sorry?
They make it based on expired patents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you actually go ahead and essentially sort of overthrow this particular, you know, structure, which has been laid down?
No, if anything, I would argue that you're supporting supporting that structure. The structure is to not extend patents, but to allow them to expire so that generic drugs, which are at a much lower cost, could be used to allow for foreign drugs to be used if they are FDA approved. And if drug companies want to do business with the United States government and its entire population, they're going to have to learn to be more competitive the same way that the Veterans Administration has competitive bid on its pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. Now, there is another part of the equation, and I'll be the first one to acknowledge that. We certainly need a better wellness program here in the United States. People should not have the expectation for every ailment that they have that they take a pill, when oftentimes it's because it's less than healthy lifestyles.
Well, going back to another economic issue, you have actually have an interesting position on gas and oil, and your position is that you want to eliminate subsidies to oil companies and place a moratorium on gas price increases. But with the oil barrel prices consistently climbing, is this really a way to do this? I mean, how are the oil companies expected to stay in business if they're going to have, like, you know, ceilings on their particular, you know, oil? And what happens when the oil reserves run out? I mean, this could very well cripple the economy.
I got to tell you, I would argue that if I didn't know any better, that you were running on behalf of a GOP-based platform, because if you believe what you're actually saying, I have some serious questions to the veracity of your statements. Let's examine. First of all, my position is that our foreign policy and our energy policy need to be separated. Why? Because I think our energy policy has gotten us into trouble over the last 50 years. We had a window of opportunity in the 1970s that we did not seize. The technology has advanced considerably as far as our ability to use alternative energies. But we have an administration that's saying that they want to reduce our dependency on oil by between 20% and 50% in the next 20 to 50 years. Quite frankly, all that's doing is passing on to the next generation, the two generations. And I would argue that if we really had resolve, there are several things that we could do, one of which I don't believe that you mentioned. Again, with the federal government's ability to declare eminent domain, there should be nothing barring it from doing so for the intellectual property of patents that currently exist, where you have energy-efficient engines, when you have alternative energies, but the energy companies would prefer that those patents were not used by the general public, because obviously it would cause a reduction in the purchase of fossil fuels. That's their bread and butter. The question is the federal government in the business to preserve big industry when it has alternatives that might be in our better long-term interest, both politically and economically? I'll give an example. Using the subsidies, if we continue to take on a principle of providing subsidies to a company, and I've taken a very close look at their 10Q filings. Those are the filings that all publicly traded companies have to provide. One of the ways that they try to reduce their profits is they raise up the amount of expenditures, and despite that fact, the profits are at an all-time high. Now, the argument made by the industry is that, yes, but that will be cyclical and it fluctuates. But the reality is it hasn't, and it hasn't in some time. So the question really should become is that if they do have that kind of profit, then the subsidies, that wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that the oil industry has a very close, cozy relationship with the Republican Party and, to some extent, the Democrat Party. That we have in the current administration 100 executives that are currently working in regulatory offices for the federal government regulating their own industry. That's the fox guarding the hen house. So what would we do? Let's say for hypothetical, we don't provide any more subsidies. Instead, we were to use those funds for alternative development. And what would that look like? It would be no different than what DARPA does with the defense industry, and it would be called the SBIR, which has been in existence for over three decades, Small Business Innovative Research. You go to academia, you say, here's the problem, here are some of the patents that currently exist out there, You got 3 years, and you got three levels of funding. The first one is introductory. The second one is prototype. The third is full production. You make it not unlike, I hate to coin this phrase because it's not mine, but like the Manhattan Project. We created a nuclear capability in 3 years. Mm-hmm. I find it very difficult to believe that we can't do that given biodiesels using algae, given switchgrass, given a hydrogen, given hybrid vehicle. I currently, one of my two vehicles is a Prius, and it does get over 50 miles to the gallon. So what would that mean at the local level? And this is where the focus is here. So what if you start with just local and state governments, using Rhode Island as an example? If you think about all the school buses, all the RIPTA, that's the bus service, if you think about the police vehicles, the highway vehicles, we're talking about thousands and thousands of vehicles. What if they were all hybrid? What if they were biodiesel? The conversion runs between $700 and $1,200 per vehicle, would obviously strengthen the economy because all of those conversions would have to be made. What does it do? Reduces demand. Currently, as I'm speaking to you, based on some recent publications by the military is currently pursuing alternative energies because they recognize that they are the largest single consumer in the world of fossil fuel products. And in a wartime footing, it's even greater. And they are currently trying to find alternative energies. So if the military understands the need, I would say that it would be pretty straightforward that the governments can. Because what that would then do is by reduction in demand, it drives down the price. Well, we have to come to some kind of reality, again, pointing to the fact that I have a financial background and I understand the game that's played by the energy industry. They control the entire supply and distribution line from the moment it extracted out of the ground to the moment that you pump it into your car. All they have to do is bottleneck any of it, and it drives up the price.
Well, yeah, we definitely know that in California. What I was going to actually ask you about was also, you know, you were talking about energy policy, and the thing that actually I'm curious about is, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this polemical book called The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler, but he suggests that we are beyond the point where we can actually sort of rectify our current oil and energy infrastructure, and that he takes sort of a pessimistic approach. Others have kind of come along and suggested that if we built more nuclear power plants and actually became less reliant upon outside energy sources, that this would actually happen. But let's say you do actually get land in the Senate seat. In 6 years, you mentioned the Manhattan Project actually happening in 3 years. Well, in 6 years, what do you think you could do to possibly sort of get the energy infrastructure to a sort of more, less reliant on outside sources and more sort of, rooted in our own sort of, you know, way to provide for us?
Well, I think the first thing is to pursue recognition that a trajectory where our energy policies and our foreign policies are interlaced guarantees a head-on collision with China. And the last time that type of resource-driven conflict occurred, it was when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. I don't think that we need to repeat history. So the real question becomes is the resolve. I think where we are in the United States right now, and I'm taking a pragmatic approach as opposed to a pessimistic approach, is the time that we could continue to defer decisions for political gain has come to a close. And the type of people that we're going to elect into office have to be straight shooting with the public. The public is not nearly as asleep as I think that Congress believes that they are. If one takes some time, there is a definite disconnect between people in the hood and people on the hill. And they are recognizing that there's got to be changes. And I would argue that we're going to see a significant transition where the 98% incumbency election rate rate is going to drop considerably because the middle class, and particularly the baby boomers that are approaching what they were hoping to be retirement security, are going to own the voting block. And they're going to be expected to be taken care of.
Sure.
And they're not going to want to hear it as far as all the excuses and all the spins. I honestly believe that. And I'm on the back end of that group. I'm 46 years old, but I can guarantee you the folks that are pushing into their 60s are very, very concerned. I think that's going to be the influence that's going to get our Congress moving in the right direction, assuming that we don't all spend it all in adventures in the Middle East and alienating many of the other countries that ought to be allies.
But going back to this energy issue, and specifically oil, I mean, for example, in China and India, the situation in both of those two countries is that they're starting to have, like, all of the auto industry is huge in both of those countries. There's this emerging middle class there,
yep.
And there's only so much oil to actually go around. We're going to, as you point out, you know, I think, you know, be squarely kind of locked against China when it comes
to... We don't need to be, though. That's my point.
Yeah.
I mean, do we continue to go in this trajectory where we literally are at that point, okay, who's going to get the soil? China is already doing strategically a beautiful job, and what they've done is if it's south of the hemisphere, China has an interest in the oil industry, whether it be Venezuela, whether it be the Middle East, whether it be Africa. They're even working with Russia. The point being is that they don't have any old scores to settle. There has been no imperialism. There's been no theocratic issues. Essentially, they go in there with solid cash and saying, look, we want to do business with you. I think that you touched upon it previously. France, 70% of their energy is generated by nuclear. Are there better ways to do that? I have no doubt that there are. But in the interim, I honestly believe that taking the course that we're taking will almost guarantee a conflict. Now, back to China, I've spent a considerable amount of time there. I was invited by the People's Republic Ministry of Education to talk about privatization there last summer. They get it. In fact, they're pursuing alternative energy options right now. And the sad fact is that they graduate more people from their colleges in the math and sciences, which are the necessary skill sets to develop these solutions, in 1 year than we do in 10.
Sure. Well, that's just the problem, though, since we're basically kind of, you know, playing a game of the ticking clock in the sense of when is the actual, you know, Hubbard's peak, when is it actually going to happen?
But we don't have to. That's my point.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is, and I think I brought this up earlier, we have what I think is a unusual, if not awesome, opportunity to start partnering with China. China's not going to grow smaller. They're going to grow larger. As you shared, their middle class is 300 million. That's our total population.
Yeah.
They offer a potential consumer block to the United States, and we offer consumer block to their manufacturers. And I would say that alternative energy is certainly a joint partnership enterprise that we could get into. They're going to be shipping their first vehicles to the United States in 2007. Sadly, those are currently being manufactured in Mexico. So we need to start looking at, as their star rises, it doesn't mean our has to set, but we have one of two choices. We either do what the British did during the late 1800s and early 1900s, where they tried to legislate stopping the American engine from growing, which obviously was not successful, or they could partner. And obviously, in the bigger scheme, the English kind of got it. They got it after getting their nose bloody because of economically we were more superior than they were. So here's the opportunity, again, using history lessons, to partner with China and their expansion as opposed to see them as a direct competitor.
Well, certainly.
And I think energy would be a perfect place to start.
But it's not just a matter of partnering out to other countries. It's also a matter of, like, you know, I mean, we have to actually overhaul the existing infrastructure. If you look at, for example, the trucking industry,
yep.
You know, I mean, the United States is the only, you know, major nation that has, you know, relies on trucks for the majority of its shipping. And something like that uses who knows how much in the way of oil or gas.
That's right.
Or fossil fuels.
And that was based on design. That's why highways prevailed as opposed to rail.
Yeah.
So, yes, absolutely. I'm not in disagreement with that, but that's also presuming that there aren't alternative sources of energy that haven't been created that would still allow vehicles to continue to motor on. It just wouldn't be using fossil fuels, or certainly a lot less of it.
But you're also talking about, like, if we were, like, say, you know, change all the trucks to Priuses for some, you know, if that was possible. I don't know. I'm not an engineer. You know, something like that takes time to actually develop and also takes great expense, because a lot of the truck drivers who drive these trucks are doing so and just barely getting by.
Yeah, and that's sort of the point. I mean, you've just made my argument. If the cost is going to be occur one of two ways. It'll either occur as a result of extended financing so that they have a hybrid engine placed in their vehicle, assuming that the expense is that great, which I've already indicated, at least on vehicles, it runs between $700 and $1,500 to make the modification. It would seem to me that what would end up happening, like all other supply chains, is when the demand goes up, the pricing goes down, it would also create a new cottage industry here in the United States. It would actually perhaps allow American manufacturers, instead of making muscle cars, to start making more energy-efficient cars. It's their wake-up call right now that Chrysler is falling down as far as its position. General Motors is now behind Toyota, and that writing was on the wall a decade ago. This is their opportunity for resurgence. So using your example of, like, a trucking industry, so what would the cost be by purchasing gasoline at $5 a gallon? How would that would erode their profit, as opposed to maybe still purchasing at $5 a gallon, but they would need to only utilize half as much, so it's the equivalent of $2.50 a gallon, with the savings going towards the expenditure, at least the short term, from a financial standpoint, into the modified drivetrain.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, I see that. Anyone can sort of see that. That's why the Prius has really sort of shot up in sales and has forced Toyota to construct more of them. But
you want to deal with reality? The reality is that the Prius has been out on the market for over 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And unfortunately, the American consumer moves more towards what they want as opposed to what's necessarily always in their best interest. And we're finally at a point financially that we have to start recognizing what Europe has gotten for decades, where vehicles are utilized for getting from point A to point B and not the luxury that we've enjoyed for so many years.
Well, certainly. But the problem here, though, is that, you know, particularly for working class families, that $750 modification is, you know, the difference between paying this month's rent and next.
No, I got to disagree with you. Okay, again, from a financial standpoint, think about that. How much more, I can tell you here in Rhode Island, the average household, as a result of additional energy costs, which is not only for the vehicle, but also for the home heating, has increased over $2,000.
Yeah.
Okay, per year. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes is that if it costs me $1,500 so that after a year I'm at break even, why wouldn't I do it?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, the problem is that this becomes another sort of cost on top of all the other sort of costs. I mean, you...
No, but it's a transition of a cost. It's not on top of, it's in lieu of, and it's a one-time expenditure. It's not a continual expenditure.
Well, of course, I understand that, but for many people, a one-time expenditure, they may not have the dough right there and then. They may actually, you know, then you're dealing with sort of setting up some sort of, like, you know, installment plan of some kind.
You set up a tax credit. I mean, in the the long term, it would be in the best interest of the American public to be weaned off of our dependence on foreign oil, and if it's a national imperative, which it ought to be, instead of having the tax credits going to the oil company, the tax credits ought to be going to the middle-class consumer that you're referring to.
Well, at the same time, you're talking about a tax credit that's collected at the end of the year. Again, it sort of goes, the issue here is that how do you sort of like, you know, do you subsidize for, you know, more impoverished people who need to make this shift? Do you subsidize them so that they are able to actually make that $100?
Well, I guess we get back into the question of is that what's the adequacy of public transportation and how many households that are in an area which we might constitute as poverty but still own two vehicles?
Sure.
I mean, now you're getting into conjecture here. I've spent a month riding the bus as part of my campaign, talking to people, you know, trying to get a sense of who rides the bus, why do they ride the bus, is the bus service adequate, what can we do better? Again, what we're dealing with is retooling the way that our American population goes from point A to point B, and how much of it is, isn't it nice? And it stops becoming nice when it erodes your ability to pay for your essentials. And those essentials could be paid for if we change some of our habits. Now, you can't legislate changing habits, but you could certainly create legislation that causes an evolution of those habits.
But
here would be a classic example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's tax cuts for the wealthy, and we still have a war. The middle class is picking up the tab in the form of higher property taxes. Why? Because those tax monies are not going to the state. The state's not sending it down to the municipality. Municipality has no place to go, so that no child left behind unfunded mandate gets to go to Joe Q Public.
But in terms of, like, you know, again, I'm sort of suggesting that the certain infrastructures exist that, you know, are prohibitive towards actually making a shift. Like, I mean, have you been to Los Angeles lately? You know, you can't actually get around Los Angeles effectively without a car. It's just, it's...
Yes, but and, as you pointed out, and many people in Los Angeles prefer to drive alone, don't they?
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Okay, and that luxury may be something that they're going to have to reconsider because of economic necessity. So I can always come up with the naysayer position. If, let's put it this way, okay, you save your life or we cut off a leg. I mean, at some point, do you really want to be faced with having to make that decision? Would it be a lot easier to say, look, you're going to have to cool some of your lifestyle habits so that we can keep the entire body intact, but it's not-